Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to The Tonight Show. A protest takes place in Dublin over the treatment of asylum seekers who've been moved out of the city centre because of a lack of government accommodation. We ask just what is the plan to address this crisis? As another Fine Gael TD quits politics, this time citing toxicity, is the job of a politician becoming too toxic? We discuss. And as all major heat records are shattered in 2023, the UN's weather agency issues a red alert on climate change.
It's clear that we are having temperatures that are well above what we used to have.
A protest has taken place outside the International Protection Office in Dublin over the treatment of asylum seekers who've been moved out of the city centre because of a lack of government accommodation. Groups from United Against Racism, Social Rights Ireland and End Direct Provision Action are calling on the government to take emergency action to find alternative shelter for the men. It comes after asylum seekers who'd been living at the makeshift camp on Mount Street were moved to an emergency site at Cruxling in South Dublin near the Wicklow border at the weekend. Well, to discuss this, I'm joined now by Fianna Fáil Senator Mary Fitzpatrick, County Wicklow Independent Councillor Gerry O'Neill, sociologist and Labour MEP candidate Niamh Harrigan, and Independent TD Michael McNamara. You're all very welcome along to the programme tonight. Mary, to come to you first, protests again tonight. The government might have thought that this was all put to bed, literally, when they moved people off Mount Street and out to Cruxling at the weekend. But there's controversy over that move. How would you assess the government's handling of the situation?
Well, I think the protests on Mount Street, it's not clear. I think they're protesting against racism from the signs that I just saw in your clip there.
Well, they're protesting at the handling of the situation and the fact that there are asylum seekers, applicants, and they are living in tents.
They surely can't be protesting that it's better to have asylum seekers living in tents on a street than living in tents in a secure facility with security, with toilets, with showers, with cooking facilities, with food, with welfare supports. They surely can't be protesting that it is better to keep people in tents with no toilet facilities, no food facilities, no welfare supports. That surely can't be a legitimate protest.
There's one thing in common with both those things you're talking about, tents in the city centre.
Absolutely.
And tents in the countryside. And they're living in tents.
Absolutely. And I agree, and I think everybody agrees, that tents are not a solution. Tents and sleeping bags in the street are not a solution. Tents and sleeping bags are not a solution. That's why we've already accommodated 26,000 people seeking international protection, not in tents. The vast majority of people who have come to our country, be they Ukrainians, 100,000, be they international refugees seeking international protection, have not been accommodated in tents. It is really unfortunate that these people are in tents and every effort has been made. It is an interim solution, as the minister has said, and the objective is to have these people moved
on. Well, to clarify, what the protesters outside the International Protection Office this evening are calling for is that those asylum seekers would have proper sheltered accommodation.
Of course, and that's what everybody wants.
All right.
They want to be properly accommodated.
Is putting someone in a tent in an open area in the middle of the Dublin mountains a solution?
You're describing it as if it's on the side of the mountain in an open area. I mean, it is in a previous HSE nursing home facility. It is a secured site with 24-hour security, 24-hour surveillance for the protection of the people who are seeking refuge. It is not ideal. Nobody would argue that it is ideal. But is sleeping on the side of a street without access to a toilet or a kitchen or food or any welfare supports ideal? Absolutely not. And that is appalling, and that had to be addressed.
Okay, I want to bring you in at this point, Gerry. You are a local councillor in the area in Crooksling. Do you think that this accommodation is appropriate?
Absolutely not. The whole idea, I mean, everyone knows that the movement from Mount Street to Crooksling was purely to clean the streets for the St. Patrick's weekend. That's very clear. Crooksling really is just a field. It's not the facilities that Mary talked about there, the showers and the canteens and the what. That's not the case. Crooksling was a nursing home there for many years, and a HSE-run nursing home. It closed in 4 years ago, and over the past 4 years, there have been crazy money spent there on security, up to over £800,000 on security. But as regards that, the buildings were left idle there over the years. And we had an incident there a couple of weeks, months ago maybe, where one of the units was burned to the ground. So, you know, it's not fair to say that the facilities were in Crooksling. There were no facilities in Crooksling. These people, they arrived by busloads on the Friday night and Saturday morning, and they were put directly in the gates. A new gate was built. They went in that gate, and they settled under trees. They settled on the lawns. There's no shower facilities. There's nothing. There's no candy. There's no facilities whatsoever for them. So, I mean, it wasn't a surprise in one way.
Have you been inside the site? Because that's not what we're hearing. I've been in and out. On that, in terms of the facilities.
Yeah, I've been in and out of that site lots of times, and it's kind of a more or less high security. I pointed out that I'm a local elected representative. I'm also a member of the HSE. And over the last month or two, on occasions, I was told to get out. And these were people with balaclavas, you know, whether it be the staff or the management groups that the government have in place there. They all seem to wear balaclavas, but I have been refused entry into Crooksling.
We have been told by Roderick O'Gorman, the Department of Integration has said that there are shower facilities, there are toilet facilities, and that there's a lot of misinformation around that. That's what the minister had to say on the facilities that are available to asylum seekers there. But from your point of view, they're not adequate.
They're not. There's no facilities. There would be the daycare centre, which was a relatively new building as such, it's 20-year-old. There would be a toilet in that in the daycare centre. But there's none of these showers. That's not correct. Mm. Why were the people sleeping out on the green, on the old lawns, which are well now overgrown? They were in the tents on the lawn. Some of them actually slept under trees in sleeping bags.
And do you fear, you mentioned there, and it's a suspected case of arson, isn't it, at the particular site in Crooksling. Do you fear that the site remains a target?
Well, you know, I suppose that's another story altogether. I hope to God, you know, I've been involved as a councillor. I'm on the Wicklow side, just across the border in Wicklow. But I've been involved in doing what I can as a councillor for the refugees, no matter where they're from. And I'm involved in, you know, the likes of the Boxing Club. We encourage the people to get involved in that, in English-speaking classes, you know. But this thing is there and it's frightening. We have other incidents around West Wicklow, like all over the country, where the threat, maybe it's really to do, Claire, with the lack of infrastructure. And that's, I think, that's the big thing, because schools are packed. There's no doctors locally. There's no infrastructure, full stop. So people generally, you know, it's natural that people would fear, 30 or 40 people coming into a town or village at the one time.
Niamh, what do you make of this move? Gerry said there at the start that this all happened because it was St. Patrick's weekend. Mm. And that's exactly why the tents were moved off the city streets and people were moved out to Crooksling. Is this alternative accommodation fit for purpose?
It's not. And I suppose for me, the issue is, first of all, that our whole approach to this crisis has been reactive. So we just react as people come in. And when the first reaction, which was had a lot of positives to it, which was to accommodate people, when that has run out of road for all kinds of reasons, the state has now moved into another reaction, which is a much less desirable one. I mean, before people were ever moved, being in tents on the side of the street with no toilet facilities, with disease potentially running rampant, was really the worst outcome possible. But even now, when we're seeing the move to Crooks Lane, we're still in the realm of reaction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Catherine Day, 2 years ago, before this blew up, said we have to move from reactive approach to migration to a proactive approach. We decide what we do. We build the correct infrastructure to do it. And COVID has shown us that we can do those kind of approaches in a relatively short period of time. It's like the government is waiting for some big pause where they can figure out the grand plan, and no such pause is going to arise. And that's really where, and in fairness to Roderick O'Gorman, I think we need to see leadership at a much higher level in government around this migration issue. And certainly, at the very least, at the very first instance, we have to take people off the streets.
But we know that the government have committed to these reception centres that were proposed in that Catherine Day report. But they say it'll take years to build them.
But look at how quickly we pulled together vaccination centres during COVID. Do you know what I mean? And like, really, if you look at the scale of that, I mean, Catherine Day's report recommended 6 large-scale reception centres. I have to say, I think that's a cop-out, given what we're dealing with right now. And given, in fairness, what IPASS have done to try and house who has been there, I think the government needs to move much quicker and much more proactively around this.
Would you concede, Mary, when you're talking about, you know, tented accommodation, albeit with some toilet facilities, and when you're saying, you know, that's just so much better than tented accommodation, you know, sleeping rough on the streets, that what you're admitting is a complete failure around accommodating and providing protection and shelter to people arriving into this country?
But 126,000 people have arrived in this country looking for accommodation, and they have been accommodated. There are 200 people, and it's 200 too many, that are being required to be accommodated in tents.
But surely it'll be more than that. Surely that number will grow, which is what we've actually seen in recent
weeks.
Well,
Claire, the objective is that it doesn't grow. That's the government's objective, is to ensure that this is a short-term interim fix until such time as more permanent accommodation can be found.
Is this always the problem, though, as Niamh said, that everything is a short-term fix when we're not looking at actually implementing policies? And I think that that paper came out, was it? It was a couple of years ago. Now, it was during COVID. And I know things stalled during that time. But even when there was more pressure on the government to do something, we still haven't got any sort of date on the construction of these centres.
First of all, when people are arriving seeking international protection, they don't call ahead, OK? That's the first thing. It's not like the government is getting this advance notice. They're making advance reservations and we're ignoring it. That's not the case. Every time that there has been a requirement on the state to step up, the state has. And to be fair to Roderick O'Gorman, I would agree. Roderick O'Gorman, as the lead minister, has brought forward proposals and is progressing them and will deliver on them.
OK, to bring you in here, Michael, Roderick O'Gorman, speaking on this issue, said there's huge pressure on the system to accommodate asylum seekers. And while this is basic, it's significantly better than accommodation on Mount Street. That's the removal of tents outside of the city centre. What do you say to that?
Well, obviously, it's entirely inadequate. It's unlawful. I mean, people who claim asylum have a right to be provided with accommodation, but only people who are applicants for international protection. A very large proportion of the people who are currently in direct provision in Ireland are not people who are entitled to accommodation under Ireland's international obligations. They're people who have had their asylum claim determined unsuccessfully, conclusively, and are still in accommodation and they've nowhere to go. The state isn't moving them on, even though they have a right to work. They get the same social welfare benefits as everybody else. They're still in direct provision, haven't been moved on. There's also...
And is that because there is nowhere for them to go to because of the housing crisis.
Even though the government consistently say that there's no link between the housing crisis and the shortage of accommodation generally in the state and the shortage of accommodation in this regard, there clearly is, because there is a large court. But even above and beyond
that, we're failing our international obligations in providing shelter.
Yeah.
So what do you do right now for the 200 men who are in tents?
Unfortunately, there are more and more people coming to Ireland claiming asylum. There aren't more and more decisions being made. There aren't people coming out of the system. There are people going in. There's a huge backlog. The Minister for Justice is responsible for a huge backlog in determining leave to remain applications. That's the end. The first stage is an application to the IPO. Okay. Then there's a right of appeal. And then there's a right to apply for humanitarian leave to remain. People are in accommodation throughout all of that. There are people waiting years for that decision. The minister won't even give statistics. I've asked them several times. She won't give statistics on how long people are waiting for her to make a decision. So this is the government's ineptitude in the Department of Justice, in dealing, and there are more and more people coming, so it becomes more and more urgent that decisions get made, but they're not being made.
And you're saying we've heard this, the Minister for Justice saying they're moving at a pace now, making those decisions.
I've heard her say that. But the truth, that is not what is happening.
And do we have statistics to show that
that's happening or not happening? She won't give the statistics. I've asked for them. The statistics were in any way favourable to the government, they'd be giving the statistics. She's refusing to give them. She's saying she doesn't even have the statistics, which I find incredible. All I can go on is what I'm hearing from the four courts where people who practice in international law are saying that the delays are getting greater and greater. On the other hand, there are people, millionaires are being made of people across this state to provide accommodation for people seeking international protection. I am aware in my constituency and from having spoken to other backbenchers in other parties that there are many direct provision centres where there are significantly, I'm not talking about where there's a room with five beds in it and there's a family of four, so there's one bed and nobody expects a stranger to be put into that bed, where there are significantly less people than are being paid for by the state. There are no controls in place by the state to check these direct provision centres. There were no inspections until I started asking about this. Now there are some inspections. Again, very hard to get statistics. But people are being paid to accommodate people who are once brought to a direct provision centre who've long since left, and they are still being paid a lot of money to accommodate them.
Like at the nub of this right now is the lack of accommodation and all the controversy that surrounds that. And, you know, when you hear what Michael has to say, that there's direct provision accommodation that is available right now in the state.
Look,
but it's not being checked and places aren't being checked to see, but people are still being paid to accommodate empty beds.
So Michael started out by complaining that the state wasn't providing adequate accommodation or suitable accommodation for people seeking refuge and protection. And he finished up by complaining about the amount of money the state is paying to accommodate. Michael, if I can just finish, I'd like to finish the point.
The state is paying money for rooms that are empty. While people are being moved up to the side of a mountain and told, camp wherever you want.
I want to respond to that anecdote. Michael doesn't know that for a fact because, as Michael says, he doesn't have the facts. Roderick O'Gorman, who is responsible for the provision of accommodation for those seeking asylum, has requested and demanded an audit of all facilities. Because there are... Michael would suggest that there may be rooms that may accommodate five people. There may be four from a family and there may be a spare bed. That bed would be counted as being vacant.
Can I just ask the question? There are no independent checks being carried out to see
There are some. A tiny amount.
Are you asking me the question or are you asking Michael?
No, I'm not.
I keep hearing his voice.
It's fine. And you can answer the question on that.
So, Roderick O'Gorman.
But just going back to the urgency right now when you do have this situation, when people are in tents, about using the accommodation that the state is paying for.
Yeah. And that is what the minister is set about doing. Like, the minister is using every available resource to deliver on our obligations to provide adequate and secure accommodation.
Gerry, can I ask you, as somebody, I suppose, who shares the view of many people in your area who don't think that, you know, putting people in, you know, closed down facilities but sleeping outdoors is the right answer. What are the alternative options?
It's a broader case. You know, we can talk about accommodation, or do we have the accommodation or do we not? Accommodation is one part of it. But what about the infrastructure? You know, we need the infrastructure behind that. We need the schools. We need the medical backup facilities. We need all that within communities. So it's just, I mean, a minister of O'Gorman could have easily, with the 200-odd people he sent out to Crook, saying he could have put the tents up in the Phoenix Park. It would have made a lot more sense. As such, the infrastructure would be there. As such, you'd have the wastewater treatment, you'd have the water. So what's the sense in hiding them behind a bunch of trees in Crook's Lane? What we have to follow up on here is that are we, you know, the box is full as such. Can we fit any more in the likes of West Wicklow, where we have Capure Lodge, we have Kilbride Army Camp, packed to the ears with people.
But
there's
just
no infrastructure
about the fact
there.
That there is accommodation. The assertion that there is accommodation, that it's not being used.
That is just accommodation. But where do these people attend schools? Where did they get the doctors? Where is all the infrastructure?
And I think
there's no infrastructure.
It comes back to the whole issue of a joined up approach and a proactive approach, because in fairness to Mary, I mean, I know that asylum seekers don't ring and give advance notice, but when Vladimir Putin walked into Ukraine, I think a lot of us could see that there were a lot of people heading our way and a lot
and
of people.
And we responded to it.
And we responded to it. But like that happened in 2022, wasn't it?
Yes, two years ago.
So, I mean, if you look at our COVID response and how quickly we managed to build significant infrastructure and a system that moved and was proactive, and we had a vision of what we were doing. And yet we're still 2 years later in this hugely reactive space where actually our reaction is deteriorating because we have no vision for what we're doing.
Most of all, we know when people come and claim asylum, their asylum claim will have to be determined. And the minister is not determining leave to remain, which is the last stage of it. She's not doing that. There's a growing backlog in the Department of Justice.
All right.
And then the Department of Children has to accommodate everybody while the Minister for Justice decides whether or not she's going to, at some point, tackle this backlog.
Just briefly on that point, actually, and it was something that Niamh mentioned as well, is that, you know, Roderick O'Gorman is dealing with this situation, but there is a lack of a joined up, you know, cross-departmental approach to all of this.
I would disagree. I think all of government is engaged in this subject. It's something that is affecting every department, right from health through education.
That's what Catherine Day said on this programme, that, you know, that the minister in the Department of Education, of integration, is in a position where he's carrying the burden.
Well, the Minister for Integration has the direct line responsibility, but the Department of Justice, the Minister for Justice, the Minister for Education, the Minister for Health are all engaged in this.
All right, there we'll have to leave that for now. My thanks to Councillor Gerry O'Neill. The rest of my panel is staying on with me next as yet another politician decides to quit politics. Is the job becoming too toxic for TDs? Do stay with us. Welcome back. Fine Gael TD Kieran Cannon has announced he will not run in the next general election, saying there's a toxicity in politics. Mr Cannon has become the 10th Fine Gael TD to announce they will not contest the next election. Fianna Fáil Senator Mary Fitzpatrick, sociologist and Labour MEP candidate Niamh Harrigan, independent TD Michael McNamara are all still with me, and we're also joined by Irish Dale.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Daily Mail Executive Editor John Lee, you're very welcome along to the programme. John, to come to you first, another day, another Fine Gael departure, it seems. They're certainly racking up. What's different about this one is that Kieran Cannon has specifically talked about toxicity in politics, if you can get your teeth around that one, that's prompted him to quit. Has this come as a surprise?
If you'd followed the case of Kieran Cannon, you'd have known there were two pretty serious incidents he's experienced in recent years relative to threats and abuse he's received. I think both of them are before the court. Certainly one was a very serious incident of threats that were made by phone. And if you'd read a piece by Finan Sheehan, he referred to some of the language that was used, and it was really, really egregious stuff. The facts show that there has been a great increase in the number of convictions of people for their conduct towards politicians. Mm. So whatever anyone thinks about what politicians do or don't deserve in the course of their work, there have been quite a few convictions. I mean, a quick tot, Kieran Cannon, there was a man before the courts. There was an unfortunate and tragic incident around that we won't go into, which saw the man not continue in the courts. Jennifer Carroll McNeill, a woman minister, of course, saw a man convicted for his conduct towards her. Most recently, Helen McEntee, Michael Carrahy, another Fine Gael senator. But also, there are incidents cross-party. Jonathan O'Brien, a former Sinn Féin TD and a current activist, had a very, very serious incident where saw a woman go to jail for 2 years. So the facts show there has been a huge increase in convictions for conduct, not ordinary run-of-the-mill political discourse. I've been in Leinster House 20 years this month now as a journalist. I would have noticed a marked change around the time of the financial crash in how politicians were treated. Daniel McConnell, a regular guest in this show, and I wrote a book about the financial crash, and principally whether people thought the conduct of the public was warranted or not. And of course, there was a tragic financial collapse in Ireland. We did record the accounts from politicians at the time of physical attacks on them. So there were physical attacks on the streets. There was one on Bat O'Keefe, Billy Kelleher, Conor Lenehan, and I remember Willie O'Dea also gave his account. So those are the facts. And treatment of politicians has degenerated since that time.
Mm-hmm. And for reasons that have swept time with a great deal, it has to be said, of public anger there, and people lost livelihoods, and the fallout from the economic crash was immense on the whole country. It was a country really traumatised. Interesting then how that anger plays out in politics. Like, Niamh, would you agree with that? I'm looking at you as someone who's... You're not also green because you've been around for 4 years yeah. in your job as a sociologist and working in the area, I suppose, of policy around politics, yeah. but entering the fray. Is this something that you're nervous about?
It is. I suppose one of the things, because I'm a political sociologist, so I spent a lot of my career writing about Irish politics, and one of the interesting things about Irish politics from a sociological perspective is how accessible historically politicians have been in Ireland. That's a strength of the Irish system, that people, if they feel they need their social welfare forms or they, you know, they go and they see that they can vote to local and to national politicians. I suppose my concern about this shift, and I think what we're really seeing is a shift from certainly a lot of the toxicity, to use Kieran Cannon's words, that was on social media, is now starting to play out in real life, which is something that we've seen happen in other jurisdictions. My concern will be that, first of all, it will put people off going into politics. But second of all, that for the people who are there, they will become less accessible and that they will, you know, get burnt out much quicker because it is a load to carry.
It hasn't put you off, though.
No, I suppose the issue for me is... I'm real about it because, I mean, I have two family members. My father was a politician for 20 years. My sister is a politician. But I suppose I feel very strongly that if you allow that to put you off, then the only people who will end up in politics are people who are desensitised to that. And do we want our government and our state to be run by people who are desensitised to abuse? Well, you wouldn't want them teaching your child. You wouldn't want them caring for you in hospital. Why would you want them representing you in Parliament?
All right. But, you know, it's interesting as well, because there are people watching this, Mary, who will say, like, if you are elected, you must take the criticism. Are politicians getting overly sensitive? Use of the word toxicity in politics. I mean, it's always been dog eat dog in politics, surely.
It's certainly a job where you've got a kind of constant review process. It's this, like, rolling performance review. You know, you're never done. You never reach a point of, yeah, you've achieved or overachieved. And everybody, I think, who goes into it knows that's they're the rules. And I think all of us who persist at it accept criticism. We welcome constructive criticism. We welcome feedback. As you said, you know, we're very accessible to the public. Mm. We answer our own phones, reply to our own emails, do our own clinics, deal with the public and engage with them all the time. And that absolutely informs our work, absolutely informs our ability to make good policy because it's based on the real lived experience of the people we're representing. So do I think politicians are precious? No, I don't think they're precious. But I do think they're human beings and I do think that they deserve a basic, decent respect, no more or no less than anybody else doing a decent job.
OK, so what does that look like?
That just looks like good manners, like good manners cost nobody anything. You can make a criticism. You don't have to be rude and abusive about it. You don't have to intimidate or terrorise another individual. You can have an alternative point of view, and that point of view may be valid to you, but it's how you deliver your message, how you communicate, and how you engage in a constructive way.
OK, Michael, do you believe it's a real factor in people quitting politics?
Yeah, I think it's a factor. I mean, it's certainly a factor. I'd say it's possibly a bigger factor in preventing people entering politics than in people quitting politics. I mean, many of the people who are quitting are quitting for a variety of reasons. I mean, it's a difficult lifestyle on top of the abuse. It's a very difficult lifestyle to combine with a family or a young family, and that's a reason cited by many who are leaving.
Yeah, interesting, because I suppose we think of when abuse is directed at politicians that it comes from those who are in power. You know, as an independent politician, when you supported government, did you feel more heat on you? Did you get more abuse? Do you think it happens regardless of whether you are in the hot seat or not?
Yeah, I mean, if there was a confidence motion in a particular minister and you supported it, obviously there was an orchestrated campaign by one particular party. But that's eased off a little bit. I mean, I think Sinn Féin realised it possibly wasn't a good look, so they've eased off on that. But there are others. I mean, certainly if you...
You're saying within the Dáil Chamber here, is that what you're talking about?
No, if you say something... No, certainly not within the Dáil Chamber, but just the keyboard warriors that people have at their disposal. I mean, there's also if you voice, for example, I was quite critical of the COVID response. Immediately, you're labelled sort of right wing or far right because you have questions. Even if you have questions about the government's immigration policy or lack of an immigration policy, then you're labelled and attacked. So, I mean, it isn't limited to, I think, any place in the political spectrum. I mean, people tend to just criticise. But I suppose it's people maybe on the extreme ends of the political spectrum who are probably most active on social media, because I suppose their views aren't often found in more mainstream media platforms. So they use that to...
And are probably
benefit.
Emboldened by being online and maybe anonymous in their criticism as well.
Well, and also, I mean, they maybe have views that aren't shared by many, but then when other people share their views on social media, they're emboldened by that, yeah.
John, in the interest of transparency, I to say you have a personal interest in this, given that you were married to a politician, Fianna Fáil Senator Lorraine Clifford Lee. Has that changed your perspective of how politicians are treated and, say, the impact of bad publicity or a critical news story?
Well, I would have been a veteran journalist when I met my much younger wife. So I was aware of the challenges in the game, and she hadn't been elected till after we got married. But we there was an instant last year when my daughter, who goes to school in town, went down to Lorraine in Leinster House, and they were leaving during one of those days that turned into that huge riot in the city, and my daughter had to be covered up in the back of the car to leave Leinster House. Such was the gravity of the riot that was going on outside. So, I mean, that brings it to your door. But it hadn't changed my perspective until that, really.
Yeah, that, I'm asking because, like, you write the stories, we cover the stories, and stories that make people rightly angry and bring attention to issues and people perhaps angry at political inaction and at their elected officials. And I suppose the question is, can't people criticise and hold politicians to account without being accused of being building a toxic environment?
Absolutely. But there's a clear definition in the law about what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. Now, I was in Leinster House on both days this year, not to personalise it. I'm there a long time. I myself, as a journalist, have received threats that the Gardaí became involved in. I'm well used to that, but certain paths have been taken in recent years that have broken the law. Now, I witnessed outside Leinster House, and it's not to personalise it, on that day that Lorraine and my daughter left Leinster House, Mary Lou MacDonald was caught up in that. There was nothing political about what was going on outside Leinster House. The guards were undermanned. That's been accepted. They lost control of the city. That's been accepted. And a few weeks after that, Drew Harris, in a major departure from what Garda commissioners have said in the past, said that they were under-resourced and undermanned at a Dáil committee. The population has increased. The nature, particularly since COVID, the nature of political protests around Leinster House and around our city, as we saw last November, has changed markedly. We had incidents I've discussed in this show before down in County Clare, where people in Michael's constituency, where people were stopping immigrants on the road and asking them where they were going. Gardaí conceded to our crime correspondent they lost control of the streets. So there's something completely different going on in recent years. And the only way to confront that is to find the difference between criticism and breaking the law. And as I instanced at the start of my contribution, there have been quite a number of convictions for behaviour towards politicians in recent years.
All right, we're out of time on that for now. My thanks to Mary and to John. The others are staying on with me. Coming up next, the UN issues a global red alert as climate records are broken. Stay with us. Welcome back. The UN's weather agency has issued a red alert on climate change after 2023 shattered all heat records. The World Meteorological Organization said records were smashed for every single climate indicator last year, including greenhouse gases, land and water temperatures, and the melting of glaciers and sea ice. Average temperatures were 1.45 degrees above the pre-industrial average. It said the past 9 years were the warmest 9 years on record, and the populations were not ready to adapt to the new normal. Well, Niamh and Michael are still clear.
We are having temperatures that are well above what we used to have, and our populations, they are not prepared to cope with that. Their infrastructure is not prepared. Their homes are not prepared. So that's why we spoke about a red alert, because we must care for the people and how they will suffer of these more frequent or more extreme events.
Well, Niamh and Michael are with me, and I'm also joined by Lauren Boland, a reporter with the Journal, with a focus on climate coverage. Lauren, you're very welcome along to the programme tonight. When you hear it laid out like that in such stark details about 2023, it sounds like a year from hell. We're now in 2024. Where are the records going to go from here? But what would be your main take from this? Because it's been described as the sounding of a red alert on climate. Take us through why it's so significant.
It really is. I mean, not only has the WMO confirmed today that 2023 was the hottest year on record, but also that the last decade is, as a period of 10 years, the hottest period of 10 years that we've seen, and that the years to come are likely to continue in the same way. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that it is... that some sirens are blaring across all major indicators and that some records aren't just chart-topping, they're chart-busting. And what really stuck out to me from the report is the detail it went into of all the extreme weather events that we've seen in the last year, just even in 2023 alone. People remember hearing about things like the wildfires in Hawaii that killed more, at least 100 people, flooding in countries like Turkey and Greece and Bulgaria and Libya, where there was major loss of life in Libya as well. And obviously we had our flooding in Middleton as well and other parts of the country last year. Extreme heat waves, so people remember the Cerberus heat wave last year in Europe. Ireland got away a little bit lightly on that one, but other parts of Europe, Italy saw record-breaking temperatures of, I think, nearly or at least 50 degrees Celsius. That's going well beyond what people might think of as something as, oh, wouldn't we like a little bit of extra heat in summer? No, this is far beyond a comfortable extra degree or two in the summer. This is really, really talking highly damaging to lives, to livelihoods and to nature.
And also, as you were pointing out there, the real brunt of climate change being felt further from home, as distinct from here in Ireland, although you mentioned the Middleton floods there. But it's those extreme temperatures, maybe in already hot countries, that are really sparking this alarm.
So we know that all of these impacts, like droughts, flooding, extreme storms, they're all on track to become more frequent and more intense with climate change. And it is, in many cases, developing countries that are bearing the brunt of that first, and especially countries often which are contributing the least to the climate crisis but are on the front lines of bearing the impacts of it, and often where climate change is exacerbating already difficult conditions. So in areas like food shortages or conflict where climate change might not be the root cause but it's a major aggravating factor.
And with all of this, I suppose it's supposed to trigger us in every country and heads of state to think about what we can do ourselves. Ireland achieving a reduction of 29% in greenhouse gases by 2030. This is well short of the 50% target we're aiming to reach. That's what it's projected now that we'll reach in terms of a reduction in emissions. So what measures can the government take now? I mean, is that target simply out of reach?
All the warnings from all the agencies in Ireland, so say for example the Climate Change Advisory Council and the Environmental Protection Agency, they have all come out in the last year and said we are majorly not on track to stay within those carbon budgets that were so hard fought for and negotiated over and laboured over in 2022 with the overall carbon budgets and the sectoral emissions limits that were so, you know, had so much thought put into them. And now we're really looking down the barrel of those being totally blown through, which has, you know, legal consequences in terms of having set legally binding targets, but also much more important to remember that those aren't just numbers on pages. They are real indicators of how we are going far beyond our limits in terms of what we're doing to the planet. And if we hope to, get back on track and to have a stable planet in the years to come, there needs to be serious ramping up of climate action.
Niamh, you're hoping to step into European politics on this one, and there have been moves such as the Nature Restoration Law and all sorts of policies that have raised concerns in the farming community, both here in Ireland and abroad. I mean, what do you think of policies that are aimed at, I suppose, nature restoration, biodiversity, meeting targets that each country needs to do and the impact that will have? Do you believe this is all positive change? Do you think we're going about it in the right way in a time of climate crisis?
I think it's very welcome. I think the problem with the current European approach to climate change is that they have this ring-fenced area called climate policy, and that's under which things like habitats directives and nature restoration come in, and they're very welcome. But the problem is that it doesn't connect to trade policy and to things like the cap. So, for instance, if you look at something like Mercosur, which is back on the agenda, which is they're trying to push over the line, Mercosur actually incentivizes South American farmers to destroy habitats. 65% of tropical deforestation is linked to beef production. And the EU is saying, yes, let's import 99,000 tonnes of South American beef. And farmers then are, I think, quite justifiably aggrieved at that, because they're saying, hang on, we have to be setting our land aside. We have to meet traceability, animal welfare, etc. And we're so there is a disconnect at European level at how the European policies in trade and other areas filter through to climate. And I think that's the bigger issue, that the 360 that Lauren is trying to get at here.
I suppose trade trumps everything, being the issue that Niamh's brought up there. Would you agree with that, that that's a problem at a time that, you know, every country has their bit to do and we're all being pushed to do our bit, but still there are controversial deals.
Germans want to sell cars to South America, so if the quid pro quo is that we cut down, that the rainforest is cut down for beef production, well, then Europe will import beef. I mean, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. I mean, yes, you know, Irish farmers have a part to play. Everybody has a part to play. But, I mean, if we displace beef production for Europe to South America, I mean, we're, you know, it's counterproductive, massively counterproductive.
So do you think there's an imbalance in what Ireland is expected to do in this global crisis, Michael?
Well, I don't think there's an imbalance in what Ireland's expected to do, but, I mean, I think there's an imbalance in what we're doing. I mean, we're not really doing very much. I mean, we've had a lot of talk about it. There was this carbon budget, which even the method it was done was profoundly undemocratic. I mean, the only thing that was agreed by the Dáil was this target, and then all the ministers went away and agreed how they'd carve it up. I mean, if that were the case, if we were really taking it seriously to be treated like a budget where you go through sector by sector and determine who's going to do what, but we didn't do that. I mean, we have...
Are there not sectoral ceilings?
Not debated by the Dáil in any way. They're just agreed sort of between cabinet ministers. How they agreed, nobody really knows. The other things, I mean, our biggest problem in Ireland is energy, and the government are consistently talking about floating wind generation off the west coast of Ireland, the huge opportunity that presents, not just for Ireland, but for Europe as a whole, because there's just such potential for energy. I was at an event, I heard the Taoiseach describe it as our moonshot, and yet nothing is happening. There was a Shannon task force that Niamh might be aware of with very ambitious plans, and step by step what needs to be done and when it needs to be done, and nothing is happening. We're talking about it, but nothing is happening. I mean, investors are coming to Ireland looking to invest in offshore wind and leaving again and going to Scotland to invest there instead, even though there's less potential in Scotland than the west coast of Ireland.
Lauren, briefly, is that fair criticism?
I think the problem that can arise sometimes with this in terms of international responsibility is everybody ends up looking around at each other and saying, I'm not going to do it until you do it. And if everybody is saying that, then how does anything ever get done?
All right, OK. And just on our own, you know, harnessing wind energy and the like, do we need to step up in that regard?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I speak to politicians about climate policy, a lot of them will turn towards the offshore wind and saying that this is going to be our holy grail, and pointing to the economic opportunities that it's going to bring as well. But the reality is that, you know, it is going to be really significant if we can do this, but it needs major ramping up to get there.
All right, OK. We'll have to leave that for now. That is it from us. Our programme is available as a podcast on all major platforms. But from all of the Late team here, good night. Take care.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.